This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Secrets to Winning at Office Politics, How to Achieve Your Goals and Increase Your Influence at Work, by Marie G. McIntyre, Ph.D., narrated by Margaret Strom. Preface. Several years ago, another consultant and I invited a mutual client, a man whom we shall call Todd, out to lunch. Our hope was that we could keep him from destroying his career. Todd was an extremely bright, capable executive with a clear and inspired vision for his organization. He had a true passion for his work and a great desire to do good things in the world. The problem, however, was that he had gotten completely sidetracked by his intense animosity toward his boss, embarking on an obsessive quest to get this man fired. As outside observers, my colleague and I could readily see that, if this war continued, the inevitable outcome would be Todd's own termination. Todd, however, could not see this at all. So, as we ate our sandwiches, the two of us tried to help Todd view the situation more clearly. No luck. Todd spent the entire lunch ranting about his boss's failings and the general unfairness of his circumstances. As we predicted, Todd was soon looking for another job. Many people experience difficulties at work because they do not accurately read their environment or correctly anticipate the consequences of their actions. Unlike Todd, however, most of them are able to correct the situation once they understand the problem. That is why I decided to create this book. Work is truly a critical component of happiness. Unlike the other creatures on the planet, people need to have a purpose. Those whose lives lack meaning feel lost and often drift into harmful, self-destructive activities. Meaningful work may be paid or unpaid, inside or outside the home. But for many of us, our sense of purpose is connected to our jobs. Unfortunately, if people lack clear goals, have unpleasant working relationships, or simply don't understand how organizations operate, the joy of accomplishment is often replaced by frustration and disappointment. When people fail to master the political side of work, their jobs may become unrewarding and unhealthy. Discovering my own purpose. Some people find their purpose in life quite early. From the time he was 12, my high school boyfriend was operating a radio transmitter in his house, from which he broadcast to the neighborhood. He now owns a radio station. Others find a new mission later in life. My multi-talented husband discovered a gift and passion for songwriting in his 40s. And some of us have a purpose that we may not immediately recognize. Although I always felt my jobs were meaningful, I didn't see the pattern in my own work until I had been employed for many years. Earlier in my career, I occupied a variety of roles, helping people with disabilities find employment, resolving disputes between employees and managers, counseling people who had lost their jobs, teaching managers to be more effective leaders, encouraging communication between executives and the workforce. I spent more time in institutions of higher learning than any sane person probably should, acquiring degrees in psychology, counseling, and management. During those years, I was a counselor, trainer, manager, and human resources director. I worked in business, government, and not-for-profit organizations. For a long time, I viewed these experiences as simply a collection of different jobs, the natural result of my desire to always be learning and doing new things. When I decided to return to graduate school to get a Ph.D., I spent some time exploring what I really wanted to do. That was when I realized that the common theme throughout my career has been the connection between people and work. My own purpose, I believe, is to help others find greater rewards in their work and overcome any obstacles that are getting in the way, including their own behavior. During my exploration of various graduate programs, one professor posed an interesting question. If you could accomplish anything with your life, what would it be? He asked. Reflecting back on my career to that point, I replied, "Actually, I wish that I could help people understand how organizations operate and help organizations understand how people operate." It seemed like an unrealistic aspiration at the time, but now that's exactly what I do. The prevalence of politics. Since leaving the employ of others, I have operated my own consulting business, working with a wide variety of organizations. My clients have included companies in telecommunications, retail, food processing, insurance, advertising, accounting, pharmaceuticals, consulting, software, manufacturing, transaction processing, and healthcare. I have also worked with many government agencies, local, state, and federal, and not-for-profit organizations. Despite the diversity of settings in which I work, the same issues arise with remarkable consistency. Here are a few of the people that I encounter on a regular basis. A confused and anxious employee who is not sure exactly what is expected by management. A tired and angry person who is clearly in the wrong job. A frustrated manager who does not know how to deal with a poorly performing employee. People at all levels who feel that their boss is incompetent, unfair, or unreasonable. Colleagues who have constant disagreements because of drastically different work styles. Entire departments at war with each other because of conflicting roles. Many, many people who feel that they are somehow being treated unfairly. All these unhappy folks are, in one way or another, dealing with political dilemmas. When you view office politics not as a Machiavellian plot, but as a normal aspect of work that needs to be managed, you quickly realize that political ability is a fundamental component of success in any job. Political topics are seldom discussed openly, however. At work, it is usually not appropriate to mention that you are furious with your boss, angling for a promotion, afraid of a colleague, or worried about your future. So people suffer in silence, feeling helpless to deal with their political predicaments and growing increasingly frustrated. The need for political mentoring. Through my consulting work, I have helped many employees, managers, and executives figure out how to handle their personal political challenges. My clients are not screw-ups or troublemakers, but competent and successful people wrestling with stressful issues that are difficult to resolve. Simply talking about these problems is often a great relief for them. In our confidential conversations, they can freely express their frustration with dysfunctional bosses, career uncertainties, challenging staff members, derailed projects, or obstructive colleagues. Listening to their difficulties, I have come to fully appreciate how much our mental and physical well-being is affected by what happens on the job. For some, the answer to their political dilemma is as simple as shifting their expectations, taking time to consider a different point of view, or having a focused discussion with a colleague. For others, the solution may require some serious self-examination and a change in long-standing behavior patterns. In either case, a political mentor can serve as a sounding board and offer a different perspective on the situation. This is frequently my role with clients. In creating this book, my goal is to provide the same assistance for listeners, to help them view their circumstances differently, keep them from becoming their own worst enemy, and suggest some new strategies and approaches. Each section of the book deals with a different aspect of workplace politics. The first section, Mastering the Fundamentals, describes basic realities of organizational life and the essential components of political intelligence. The second, Avoiding Political Pitfalls, discusses the destructive games and personal blunders that can lead an unsuspecting individual into a political quagmire. Finally, How to Become a Winner provides specific strategies that can improve your political position and increase your influence. My hope is that this book will help you achieve your own personal and business goals, whatever they may be, so that work can become an even more enjoyable and meaningful part of your life. A note to colleagues and clients. This book contains many examples. Although all are true stories, the names, titles, and/or occupations have been changed. If you believe you recognize yourself or someone else, please keep in mind that many people have similar problems, dilemmas, and challenges. You may very well see yourself in someone else's story. Examples are useful because people learn much more from reality than they do from abstract concepts. The life experiences of my clients and colleagues have made an invaluable contribution to this book, to its listeners, and to my own political education. For that, I am deeply appreciative. A note to listeners. If you would like to share your own political stories, dilemmas, or insights, please visit my website at yourofficecoach.com. I'd love to hear from you. Part 1. Mastering the Fundamentals. Chapter 1. Politics is not a dirty word. Playing politics is like having sex. Almost everybody does it, but nobody is comfortable discussing exactly what they do. We will talk for hours, however, about what other people might be doing. Typically, we use the term playing politics only to describe our colleagues' behavior, never our own. They are sucking up, scheming, and manipulating, but we are building relationships, developing strategies, and opening communication channels. Many people feel that playing the political game involves devious plotting or blatant self-promotion. But in reality, politics is what naturally happens whenever people with different goals, interests, and personalities try to work together. We are all continuously engaged in political transactions throughout the normal course of every workday. The process itself is neither good nor bad, but simply a fact of life. And the morality of the outcome is determined entirely by the motives and goals of the players. Both Hitler and Mother Teresa might be considered politically adept, but their results are judged rather differently. How do you win at politics? The political side of work quickly becomes apparent as soon as we take our first job. To succeed, we not only have to do outstanding work, but we also have to deal with quirky bosses and annoying coworkers. Colleagues get defensive when we point out their mistakes. Unscrupulous rivals try to stab us in the back, and managers make decisions that seem totally unfair or completely idiotic. Learning to deal with these realities and succeed in spite of them constitutes our on-the-job political education. Every office is a playing field for the game of politics. And when you take a job, you're automatically a player. Kelly learned this lesson the hard way. After graduating from college with a marketing degree, she accepted an administrative assistant position in the marketing department of a large corporation, viewing it as a temporary step toward her professional career. But as the months passed, Kelly became increasingly discouraged. Every time she applied for a promotion, she was rejected, with no clear explanation of the reason. Finally, feeling trapped and desperate, she went to her boss and asked for some honest feedback. Much to her surprise, Kelly learned that people viewed her as egotistical and arrogant. The unanticipated result of her desire to get into a marketing position. Striving to be noticed by management, Kelly had tried to demonstrate her superior knowledge and skills at every opportunity, but this tactic had backfired. Her condescending manner completely alienated the other assistants, who quickly spread the word that she was difficult to work with, thereby killing her chances of being promoted. Kelly was stunned by the feedback, but her political education had begun. In her eagerness to succeed, Kelly made a common mistake. She failed to realize that managing the political environment is just as important as managing tasks and responsibilities. Winning this game means acquiring the political power necessary to accomplish the goals that matter to you. We sometimes equate success only with rapid advancement, but not everyone is interested in promotions. Autonomy, security, responsibility, skill development, challenge, and interesting work are a few of the other rewards that people often hope to find through their jobs. When I recently surveyed 220 people from business and government organizations about their views on office politics, these were some of the responses to the question, when people are good at politics, what are they able to do? Get their projects moved up the priority list. Play golf with important people. Influence management. Have their own office. Bypass normal procedures. Advance quickly. Get asked to solve the toughest problems. Receive more recognition. Accomplish results. Get things done despite great obstacles. Get senior management to buy in on projects. Help bring about changes. Get other people to do their work. Draw attention to a project. Get more money in their budget. Acquire resources for their staff. Stay out of trouble. Have their ideas heard. Get raises when other people don't. Survive changes. The common theme running through these answers is that politics is about getting what you want, whatever that may be. And to get what you want, you must be able to influence others. Kelly provides a clear example of political failure. She has inadvertently created adversarial relationships that present a serious obstacle to reaching her career goals. To respond to this catastrophe, she needs a political strategy that will reverse the negative opinions held by her coworkers and her boss. If she succeeds in shifting these perceptions, her odds of moving into a marketing slot will greatly increase. Although a well-crafted political game plan can represent the difference between success and failure, candid discussion of strategic maneuvers sometimes makes people uneasy. Purposeful strategizing is often mistakenly viewed as scheming or plotting. In Kelly's situation, a wise mentor might suggest that she needs to cease her obvious self-promotion and seek out opportunities to assist her colleagues. There is nothing manipulative about this advice. It's just practical and beneficial for the business as well. Increased cooperation among the assistants should not only improve Kelly's image, but also help the department run more smoothly. Although she needs to be less blatant about it, Kelly should continue to look for chances to get to know managers in the marketing department and to demonstrate her potential. You always have a better shot at accomplishing your goals if the people in power support you, but they can hardly support you if they don't know who you are. Making yourself known in appropriate ways is simply smart. But talking about specific tactics can make people cringe a bit. Just as some have a natural aptitude for math, music, or golf, others seem to possess innate political talent. These instinctive abilities give them the same competitive advantage at work that natural athletes have in sports. But while you can improve your golf score by signing up for lessons, it's pretty tough to find tutoring in office politics. Because the frank discussion of strategy is frowned upon, people with political dilemmas often have to suffer in silence. By openly discussing the secrets of office politics and describing the attitudes, behaviors, and approaches that contribute to success, this book is designed to help you understand and manage the political process in your organization. So here's lesson number one. To win at office politics, you must first clearly define your goals. What do you want? If you took a poll and asked people why they work, what do you think they would say? Money is usually the first reason that comes to mind. But in addition to financial security, work provides many other benefits. We can learn new skills, interact with congenial people, take pride in accomplishments, and identify with a meaningful purpose. Although we complain about our jobs and dream about vacations, most of us get a lot more from work than just a paycheck. Let's consider two people who represent opposite extremes in their political goals. First, we have Sergio, a young sales manager who knows exactly how he wants his entire career to unfold. Sergio likes the company he works for and hopes to stay there. He has a plan. First, transfer to a position with a larger sales territory, then apply for a regional director job, with the ultimate goal of becoming vice president for North American sales. And CEO wouldn't be out of the question. Sergio is clearly an ambitious, goal-driven guy. At the other extreme, we find Joan, an executive assistant in the legal department of a large corporation. "I really don't have any work goals," she said to me. "I just come in every day and do my job." This sounded like someone working mostly for a paycheck, so I inquired about her life outside of work. Her whole face lit up as she enthusiastically described her community and church activities. Like many people, Joan is motivated by something other than her job and works primarily to finance the rest of her life. But she actually does have goals related to work. She wants to remain employed and enjoy her time at the office as much as possible. People whose eyes glaze over when asked about their goals often find it much easier to answer this question. How would you like things to be different? Joan had a ready answer for that one. She was getting a little bored and wished that her work could be more interesting. Politically speaking, Sergio needs to position himself for the next promotion, while Joan needs to acquire some new responsibilities or find a more rewarding position. As an organizational psychologist, I frequently encounter people who are having difficulty with some aspect of their job. They may be uncertain of their next career move, angry at a demanding boss, excluded from an important project, annoyed with uncooperative colleagues, afraid of failing at a tough new assignment, unsure of how to sell an idea to management, burned out from ongoing job stress, or experiencing a host of other problems. After we discuss their dilemma, my first question is always the same. What are your personal goals in this situation? If they aren't sure of the answer, then that's where we start, because all subsequent decisions and actions need to be driven by their own individual desires. An old saying provides this advice. If you're not sure where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. When thinking about your goals, here are some questions to consider. Do you want to stay with your current organization or find a different place to work? Do you want to remain in the same field or consider a different occupation? Would you like a more comfortable relationship with your boss? Do you want to be given more challenging and interesting assignments? Are you interested in getting promoted or expanding your responsibilities? Do you want more recognition for your contributions or accomplishments? Would you like a better working relationship with certain people or departments? Do you simply want to keep your current job in order to finance the rest of your life? Sharpening your political ability can increase the odds of accomplishing whatever objectives are important to you. But first, you must clearly differentiate between goals and wishes. The difference between a goal and a wish. When we are having problems at work, we often think in terms of wishes, not goals. I wish that I could make more money. I wish I had gotten that promotion instead of Susan. I wish that my boss wasn't such a moron. I wish my employees would pay attention to deadlines. I wish a headhunter would call and offer me a job. Wishing is a passive activity that can easily degenerate into whining and complaining. Goals, on the other hand, help to define the actions we need to take. The more time we spend wishing, the less time we spend actually accomplishing anything. Fortunately, our wishes usually contain clues to our political objectives. The CEO of a healthcare company hired me to provide some coaching for Jeff, an executive who was driving him crazy. After a reorganization, Jeff no longer reported to the CEO, but to a newly hired senior vice president. Yet Jeff was acting as though this change had never happened, continuing to go to the CEO for information and seldom responding to requests from his new boss. He frequently made snide, sarcastic remarks about the situation within earshot of the CEO. "Do something about him," the CEO ordered. "He's got a lot of future potential here, but not if he keeps acting like this." When Jeff and I got together, he embarked on a long, rambling tirade about unqualified executives, stupid decisions, and general unfairness. Then I asked the key questions. What do you want in this situation, Jeff? What are your goals? Are you planning on a career with this company, or are you ready to leave? Without the answer to these questions, Jeff's future course of action is unclear. If he is so disillusioned that he wants to seek greener pastures elsewhere, then he needs to begin making outside contacts. On the other hand, if he plans to remain with this company, he needs to be perceived as a helpful, contributing member of the management team. When we first met, however, he was expending his energy in the least productive way possible, obsessing about the past, complaining about his new boss, and wishing that things would magically return to their previous state. Jeff responded that he did indeed want to stay with this company, but wished that he could return to his previous level. If that is his goal, he has additional questions to consider. What can you do to move in that direction? And is your current behavior helping? Clearly it wasn't. But Jeff hadn't previously thought about it that way. In fact, he really wasn't thinking at all. He was angry and hurt and acting out his feelings. Once he decided to stop focusing on his resentment, he could consider the future and define his goals. Having chosen to stay with his company, Jeff now had a clear guideline to follow when interacting with others, including his new boss. What would a cooperative and committed member of the management team do in this situation? By using this guideline to make conscious decisions about his behavior, he was able to repair his management relationships and get back on a positive career track. Wishes put the focus on what we want them to do. Goals highlight what we can do ourselves. Wishes take us out of the power position by implying that we are at the mercy of others. Goals give us power by describing results that we intend to accomplish. When converted to goals, the wishes we talked about earlier would sound like this. I am going to develop the skills I need for a higher paying job. I will ask my manager about how to prepare myself for the next available promotion. I am going to start communicating in a more positive way with my boss. I am going to discuss the importance of deadlines with my employees and see that they meet them. I plan to update my resume and start checking out jobs in my field. Goals imply action. Wishes imply sitting around and waiting for something to happen. Changing from wishful thinking to goal-directed planning doesn't guarantee that you will get what you want, but it certainly increases your odds. Four political types. Typically, our goals at work fall into two categories, business and personal. Business goals relate to the responsibilities of your position, such as accomplishing expected results, developing creative approaches to problems, and doing anything else that will make the organization more successful. Personal goals, on the other hand, focus on what you want for yourself, such as developing new abilities, getting assigned to interesting projects, or being promoted to a higher position. Sometimes our actions help us to achieve these goals, and sometimes they have the opposite effect. Jeff's childish response to getting a new boss, for example, was clearly harmful to both his career and his company. Four common political types can be described by the way their behavior affects both business and personal goals. Listen closely. Do any of these people sound familiar to you? Martyrs try to help their organizations, but at high personal cost to themselves. They usually wind up feeling unappreciated and resentful, an attitude that eventually bleeds over into their interactions with others, no matter how they may try to hide it. And some of them don't try to hide it at all. Eventually, martyrs burn out, either personally or professionally. Emily, a vice president of customer service, provides a prime example of a self-sacrificing martyr. For many years, she reported to a relentlessly demanding CEO who constantly changed Emily's goals, bombarded her with requests for information, repeatedly criticized her staff, and denied all her requests for additional resources. Periodically, he would also tell her how important she was to him, confide in her about confidential problems, and insist that she was the only person he could really trust. Despite her growing fatigue and depression, Emily continued to try to do everything the CEO expected, working longer and longer hours and becoming increasingly stressed by his ever-changing demands. Imagine her shock and dismay when she learned through the grapevine that the CEO was interviewing candidates for her job. Ironically, the CEO had come to view obliging and obedient Emily as an unassertive doormat. Her eventual replacement worked fewer hours, was allowed to hire more staff, and was paid twice as much. Emily was a pathological pleaser, but martyrs also come in a more militant variety, crusaders who are true believers in a cause. Although crusading martyrs usually have the interests of the organization at heart, their approach to advocacy often torpedoes their own career. When these martyrs jump on their soapbox, their adamant and single-minded preaching tends to make people run the other way. For example, the dedicated quality assurance specialist whose finger-pointing about defective products alienates her manufacturing colleagues. the brilliant corporate attorney whom managers try to circumvent because he always throws up roadblocks to their plans. The social worker who rants about bureaucratic barriers so frequently that no one hears her valid complaints about policies that are harmful to clients. Ironically, their poorly handled quest to make things better usually deprives these martyrs of the very influence they seek. Sociopaths are interested only in their own needs, wants, and desires. Their self-centered fixation on personal goals damages their organizations, but they don't care about that. This comment from the survey on About Office Politics provides an apt description of sociopaths. Able to achieve a certain amount of success, but their actions tend to come back to haunt them in one way or another. Sociopathic executives can wreak havoc on a company, as illustrated by the corporate scandals involving CEOs who appropriate company funds for lavish personal indulgences, or who use illegal accounting procedures to enrich themselves at the expense of employees and shareholders. Other executive sociopaths have been known to award themselves large bonuses while their companies were losing money and employees were losing jobs. But selfishness is not the exclusive property of top management. Many sociopaths can be found at lower levels as well. This unsavory group includes not only people who steal time, money, equipment, or customers, but also those who meet personal objectives in a way that creates problems for others. Jeremy was a compensation specialist who did virtually no work. He sat in his office all day, reading magazines, making personal calls, and doing crossword puzzles. Every so often, he would crank out a report or a memo to keep up appearances. Jeremy was essentially stealing from his company by accepting a paycheck for work he never performed. Because he had once won a discrimination lawsuit, he thought that no one would have the nerve to fire him. For several years, he was right. A different variety of sociopath is exemplified by Victoria, a computer technician. For many years, Victoria was engaged in a long-term affair with the married head of her department, who was several levels above her in the organization. Because she made her special connections widely known, she became a political untouchable and used this status to intimidate anyone who got in her way. If someone displeased her, she would blast co-workers with scathing emails that were always copied to her boyfriend. She demanded to be included in highly technical projects, although she lacked the necessary skills. People throughout the company tried to steer clear of any endeavor that involved Victoria because she was so difficult to work with. Her immediate supervisor felt completely powerless because he knew that any conversation with Victoria about performance issues would immediately result in unwelcome attention from the department head, who obviously shared the blame for this disastrous situation. Because they often do succeed in obtaining immediate personal benefits, in the short run, sociopaths can look like political winners. However, their self-centeredness almost always limits their long-term success. Because of her difficult reputation, Victoria remained stuck in a dead-end job, and probably a dead-end affair as well. Jeremy was eventually let go, and many sociopathic executives have lost their jobs, forced their companies into bankruptcy, or gone to jail. Dimwits exhibit behavior that is both self-destructive and harmful to the organization. Their actions seem to be driven by psychological needs over which they have little control. Mark was a chronically angry dimwit. In meetings, he verbally attacked co-workers who disagreed with him, storming out of the room if he seemed to be losing the argument. He raised vehement objections to any new idea, especially those that might create extra work for him. He felt no hesitation about yelling at his boss, always a dangerous practice. Eventually, he was fired. Don, a lustful dimwit, was a partner in a small business. Whenever an attractive woman joined the staff, he would flirt with her, put his arm around her, and ask joking questions about her sex life. When the company became involved in a sexual harassment lawsuit, Don was personally embarrassed, and the business suffered as well. Lucinda, a management dimwit, believed that the way to improve her staff's performance was to berate them for mistakes on a regular basis. Even when she tried to be positive, her negative impulses eventually took over. After giving a motivational speech about all the good work the group had done that year and all the exciting things they could do in the future, she ended by saying, "And if you don't like it here, you can just leave." Many of them did. Lucinda's staff turnover rate increased every year, eventually causing top management to investigate the situation. Lucinda herself was turned over shortly thereafter. Winners are people whose behavior at work contributes to both business and personal success. I believe that these are the folks who succeed at office politics, especially in the long run. Glenn was a winner. He joined his company as an accountant, but knew that he wanted to do more. As his career progressed, he learned about other areas of finance, took on several highly visible projects, delivered results in the face of difficult obstacles, got to know company executives, and developed many positive working relationships. Glenn became known as a pleasant, helpful person who always did an outstanding job. Eventually, he moved through several management positions to become vice president of finance for the largest division in his company. At each step, he tried to improve operations and help his staff develop new skills and abilities. Some people may have envied Glenn's success, but almost everyone agreed that it was well deserved. Those who consistently behave like martyrs, sociopaths, or dimwits are doomed to eventual failure and disappointment. Their political power is automatically limited by their excessive behavior, which gradually alienates everyone around them. Although most of us are not so extreme, we all act out of bitterness, selfishness, or uncontrolled emotion from time to time. Sadly, these destructive tendencies prevent many people from reaching their full potential as winners. One goal of this book is to help you spot your own political weaknesses and take steps to correct them. There are no perfect people. We all have little deviations in our personalities that make us unique, interesting, and sometimes annoying. And what a boring world it would be otherwise. So keep your endearing eccentricities, but consider changing any behaviors that may reduce your influence, harm your working relationships, or keep you from getting what you want. Remember, you may have the intentions of a winner, but your actions will determine how you are viewed by others. The ethics of office politics. Ruthless and immoral players give the game of office politics a bad name. Fortunately, however, the ethically impaired almost always experience an eventual downfall. Because people driven solely by personal gain or other selfish motives are seldom successful in the long run. Winning the political game requires that you consider the ethical implications of your decisions. Given that most of us work for pay, ethical issues on the job often come down to the question of what we are willing to do for money. Only a tiny minority of people would agree to kill or harm someone for cash. But would you lie? Falsify records? Fail to report violations of law? Tolerate unsafe working conditions? Your automatic response is likely to be, no, of course not. Think about it another way, though. Imagine you'll be fired if you refuse to falsify a report. Now would you do it? In the realm of ethics, only actions count. Your moral code is communicated not by what you say you believe, but by what your behavior actually demonstrates. During the course of a career, almost everyone will encounter ethical moments, situations that force us to decide whether or not to live up to our personal standards. One of my ethical moments occurred when I was responsible for internal communications in a large corporation. When a high-level manager suggested sending out false information to employees, I realized that lying to people who relied on me for accuracy was not something I could live with. But I did not leap to my feet and cry, "You liar! How could you ask me to do such a thing?" Instead, I simply explained that if we were caught in an obvious lie, our future credibility would be ruined. Fortunately, this pragmatic reasoning was accepted by the executive, whose value system did not exactly highlight honesty. I was relieved not to have to lay my career on the line for this issue, but I did realize that I would resign before sending out information that was blatantly untrue. Such decisions are easier when you have clearly defined your moral parameters. This political golden rule should be followed by anyone hoping to become a winner. Never advance your own interests by harming the business or hurting other people. If you feel this is overly altruistic, then consider some practical realities. Selfish and mean-spirited actions will likely provoke similar responses from others in the future. Assistance may not be forthcoming when you need it, and nasty rumors about you may spring up on the office grapevine. If you help yourself in ways that hurt the business, by lying, stealing, taking unacceptable shortcuts, or doing substandard work, you run the risk of getting caught and seriously damaging your career. So whether you are motivated by moral or practical considerations, following the political golden rule is more likely to promote your long-term political and professional success. Personal politics. The personal politics section at the end of each chapter is intended to help you relate the secrets of winning at office politics to your own work situation. By the end of the book, you will be able to create a detailed political game plan for accomplishing your goals. But the first step is to convert your wishes into goal statements. Are you focused on wishes or goals? Assessing your situation. Create a mental picture of your working life as you would like for it to be 2 years into the future. Close your eyes if that helps. Or draw a picture, if that works for you. Once you have a clear image of the ideal future in mind, list everything that would be different from the way it is now. These are your wishes. Moving from assessment to action. To actually create your ideal future, you need to convert your wishes into goal statements, because goals force you to focus on what you yourself could do to change the situation. Don't waste your energy thinking about what someone else should be doing. That won't get you anywhere. Look at your wish list and convert those wishes into goals. If you're not sure how to do that, the steps are described here. 1. Define the specific result that you hope to achieve. For example, saying, "I want more money," isn't specific enough. You could accomplish that by robbing a bank or murdering your wealthy aunt. But saying, "I want a job that pays twice what I'm making now," is pretty clear. 2. Consider what obstacles are keeping you from that result. In the example of the higher-paying job, obstacles might include a lack of education, a limited career path, or being perceived negatively by the people who make promotional decisions. 3. Now here's the hard part. Figure out what you personally can do to overcome those obstacles. For example, if you lack education, how can you get it? Or if you're in a job with limited potential, what can you do to get into a more promising field? If certain people perceive you negatively, how can you begin to change those perceptions? 4. Turn those ideas into goal statements. A goal statement starts with I, uses an action verb, and describes something specific that you will do, such as, I will get information about degree programs with class schedules that fit my work hours. Or, I will research career options that fit my skills and experience. Or, I will talk with my boss about how to get considered for a promotion. 5. For each goal, identify the first step toward accomplishing it. Then do it. Then take the next one. Big goals often seem much more manageable if you simply focus on the next specific action that you need to take. Turning wishes into goals. 1. Desired result. What do I specifically want? 2. Obstacles. What is keeping me from getting what I want? 3. Personal actions. What can I personally do to overcome those obstacles? 4. Goal statement. I will. 5. The first step. What specific step do I need to take now? What is your political type? Assessing your situation. If you have recognized yourself as a martyr, sociopath, or dimwit, you need to change some fundamental attitudes about your work situation. What basic beliefs are getting you in trouble? Do you feel that you need to please everyone? Be in control of every situation? Always be right? Get your own way? List the attitudes that may be causing you problems. Then list the unproductive behaviors generated by those attitudes. Even if you are a winner, you may occasionally lapse into harmful behaviors. Do you ever find yourself acting like a martyr, sociopath, or dimwit? If so, what specifically are you doing? What would an outside observer see? List any behaviors that might keep you from achieving your work or career goals. Moving from assessment to action. Now that you have identified your unproductive behaviors, determine what you will do differently in the future. Beside each negative behavior, list the positive behavior that will replace it. For example, if you have listed, I respond angrily when colleagues won't do what I want, then the replacement behavior might be, when colleagues won't do what I want, I will ask questions to understand their point of view and try to reach a compromise. Specific suggestions on changing behavior are provided at the end of Chapter 6. What are your ethical dilemmas? Assessing your situation. Does your job present any potential ethical challenges? Do you admire the ethical standards of management in your organization? Are you ever asked to do things that don't feel quite right? Moving from assessment to action. If you have ethical conflicts at work, you have three choices. 1. Continue to compromise your own standards because of the other benefits provided by your job. 2. Try to change the situation by discussing it with the appropriate people. Or, 3. Find a more compatible place to work. Only you can decide which is the best course in your situation. Chapter 2. Political intelligence and the facts of life. To be a winner at office politics, you must accept certain fundamental truths about the way organizations operate. Unfortunately, these realities often conflict with cherished beliefs held by those of us raised in a democratic society. To illustrate the problems created by unrealistic expectations, let's consider the sad story of Alan. Although he undoubtedly would describe himself as a victim of politics, Alan actually committed workplace suicide through a complete lack of political ability. Political Warfare, the true story of Alan and Barbara. Alan was extremely excited about his new job as executive director of the Horizon Center, a large counseling agency located in a metropolitan area. In his previous position, Alan had found himself embroiled in numerous conflicts with his boss, who was a fool, and several staff members who were borderline incompetent and had no interpersonal skills. At least, that was Alan's opinion. But now, those problems were in the past. On his first day, Alan met with the staff to describe his vision for the Horizon Center. He wanted to upgrade facilities, expand services, and increase the center's influence in the community. He felt that the center should go beyond helping individuals and become more involved in public education about mental health issues. The staff was energized. They couldn't wait to start moving in this new direction. A few days later, Alan made the same speech to his board of directors, but was disappointed by their lukewarm response. The chairperson, Barbara, kept having side conversations during his presentation and even left the room to check on arrangements for lunch. The remainder of the board meeting involved operational decisions Alan felt should have been left up to him. He concluded that these people didn't really understand how a board was supposed to function. During the next few weeks, Alan began to implement changes with the enthusiastic support of his staff. But several meetings with Barbara convinced him that she was completely clueless about the proper role of a board chair. Although he tried to teach her about management and help her understand his plan, she only seemed interested in expense report procedures, client record keeping, and the redecoration of the lobby. Unfortunately, since Barbara had just been elected to a 2-year term, he was stuck with her. As he learned more about her background, Alan decided that Barbara was only on the board because her family had money and was related to the mayor. Growing up in a poor family, Alan had watched rich, connected people in his hometown weasel their way into positions of influence, while his own father had to work 2 jobs just to send his kids to college. Life was so unfair. As the months went by, Alan frequently complained to the staff about the board's ignorance and lack of appreciation for his ideas. He gave a series of lectures during board meetings to try to bring the members up to his level. The relationship between Alan and Barbara continued to deteriorate, hitting an especially rocky patch over the hiring of a new staff member. Alan had found an applicant with impeccable credentials, including a PhD in counseling. Barbara, however, preferred a candidate with fundraising experience who had been referred by her cousin, the mayor. After lobbying several board members, Alan won this battle and viewed his victory over Barbara as a good sign. Encouraged by his triumph in the hiring dispute, Alan arranged individual meetings with influential board members to discuss how Barbara might be removed from her position. Although they listened politely, none offered any definite support. In the ensuing weeks, Alan became increasingly obsessed. He stopped talking with Barbara directly, but continued to recount tales of her misdeeds to anyone who would listen. The staff was now split into 2 camps. Those who agreed with Alan that Barbara was the root of all evil, and those who felt that Alan's obsession with her was hurting the center. Some staff members stopped speaking to one another. Early one morning, Alan received a phone call requesting his presence at a meeting of the board's executive committee. When he arrived, Alan was told that his employment was being terminated and that he was to pack up his office immediately. The war with Barbara was over. Alan had lost. As he drove away from the Horizon Center, Alan wondered why every place he worked was filled with such stupid, incompetent people. Developing political intelligence. Given his intense dedication to the organization, Alan might be considered a martyr. While trying to help the Horizon Center succeed, he gradually brought about his own destruction. Toward the end of his tenure, however, he was rapidly moving into the dimwit category because his obsession with Barbara was beginning to hurt the entire organization. Allen may have been a visionary, but his political instincts were virtually non-existent.